Good morning. I'd like to bring the House Committee on General Government and Consumer Protection to order this morning. It is the first day of the regular session and the first committee meeting for the regular session of this committee. It is February 1st. And committee members, there was a few committee members, some of the new people as well, that wanted to have sort of an informational meeting about what this committee really does and what some of the topics we cover are. And certainly it's a wide range of topics, and we never know what we will get or what we don't get. And so Co-Chair Gene Wisnant and myself decided to have a informational meeting with four different agencies reporting. And I don't know if we would like to maybe do committee introductions. We did that during the organizational meeting, Mr. Co-Chair. But
thank you, Mr. Chair. I think we at least need to recognize that Representative Sheehan has been redesignated as vice chair, and we have Kevin Cameron joining the committee. So I think
right, and we have Representative Smith, who'll be joining us also as a vice chair as well.
Yeah, I'd like to, Mr. Chair, that new members don't follow the example of these older members on attendance or being here promptly.
Right. It is nice to be able to start on time, especially since we're going to have a lot of issues coming up and a pretty heavy workload for such a short-lived committee, meaning that it's got 2 days a week. So with that, I think we'll start out, and first up on our list is the Attorney General's Office, and we'll invite up Chief of Staff and Special Counsel to the Attorney General, Keith Stabanovich. Welcome back. It's good to see you this year. Happy New Year. And we're hoping that you can sort of give us an overview of the Attorney General's Office in relationship to consumer protection and general government.
Co-Chair Holte, Co-Chair Wisnant, good morning. My name is Keith Stabanovich, and I'm Chief of Staff and Special Counsel to the Attorney General. Thank you for inviting me to come and speak with you this morning. And what I would like to do is to give you a general idea of the activities of the Department of Justice and give you some specific case example of what we have done over the last year. In 2010, through the legal actions of your Department of Justice, we recovered more than $22 million for Oregon workers, consumers, and taxpayers. And that's done without spending a single taxpayer dollar. We have a fairly innovative program that funds our consumer protection efforts through the recoveries that we make in the cases that we bring. And as a consequence, since 2003, not a single taxpayer dollar has gone into the consumer protection efforts of the Department of Justice. Now, our section, which is called the Financial Fraud Consumer Protection Section, consists of 12 attorneys, 6 investigators, and 6 enforcement officers. We are also supported by a tremendous team of volunteers who staff our call-in line. We have a hotline, consumer hotline, that people can call for consumer questions. And it is staffed 100% by volunteers, and those volunteers field over 30,000 calls a year. So as you can see, it's a very efficient and cost-effective consumer protection program. In general, our process is to help the consumer resolve whatever dispute they have with the business. We do not pick sides. Our job is to facilitate their dispute, and most of the time, the consumer is able to resolve their issue directly with the company. So, for example, a consumer will call our hotline, voice a complaint. We request that they put it in writing so that everybody knows specifically what they're dealing with, and then we turn that written complaint over to the business. Oftentimes, we find that the consumer has not had adequate communication with the business. So by providing the business a copy of the written complaint, the business now knows what the consumer's concern is. And most of the time, the business will resolve the dispute directly with the consumer. Sometimes, when we have a series of similar complaints, they escalate up to our investigators to try and find what is the common thread. And even more rarely, they will sometimes end up on the desk of one of our lawyers, who will then initiate a proceeding and an investigation. And our proceedings are usually, we do an investigation, we send what's called a draft assurance of voluntary compliance to the business that describes what our concerns are and proposes a resolution of the case. In very, very few instances does the Consumer Protection Section of the Department of Justice actually file lawsuits. A vast majority of the complaints that we get, as I said, are resolved initially by the consumer, and very few of the cases that actually end up on a lawyer's desk end up actually going to litigation. And that's because most of the time when we propose an assurance of voluntary compliance, the business enters into discussions with us, we reach a compromise, and the case is resolved. One thing that we do is we keep track of the complaints that are filed so that we can provide you information about what the trends are, and also so that we can adequately deploy our resources in the department. So each year we produce what we call a top 10 list, and we're still compiling the data from 2010. It is, we believe, fairly reflective of what happened in 2009, and I'll just give you the highlights. The largest number of complaints that we get arises out of the telecommunications industry. Virtually everyone has a cell phone, probably has either satellite television or cable. They have an internet service provider, and at some point or another, all of us have had some problem with one of those services or a complaint about our bill. And that industry or industries creates the largest number of complaints to our database. The second is international money transfers. And if you have not been solicited and told that you already won, then I'm sure I can provide that information to you. Amazingly, in 2009, Oregonians reported losing over $700,000 to international money scams. And it's quite difficult to prevent, and even more difficult to prosecute, because most of the time the entities or people that try to and perpetrate these scams are overseas, and it's quite difficult for us to be able to go after them. So what we spend a lot of our time doing is educating consumers, trying to help them avoid it. And so we have a consumer educator that is traveling the state, talking to community groups in all corners of our state, big and small community groups, from the Lions to the Elks and every other community group, in an effort to educate them on these scams and prevent them from becoming a victim. In 2009, we instituted what we called a scam alert, which notifies community groups and individuals of some of the more recent scams that are taking place. A classic example is when the Ducks got to go to the BCS Bowl game. Of course, there were now bowl scam tickets available, and people were being told that all they needed to do is send in a check for $100 and they'd have 50-yard line tickets along with the room, and of course it was a scam. So what we immediately did once we heard about it is send out a scam alert to let people know about the scam so that hopefully they could avoid it. The number three type of complaint that we get in frequency are motor vehicle sales. Because a car is the second largest purchase after a home, it's not surprising that we have a lot of complaints about motor vehicle sales. They're almost equally split between new car dealers and used car dealers. And as fewer and fewer new cars are sold and people are now moving into used cars, we're seeing an increased number of used car complaints. Number four is not surprising, and that's financial institutions, and those include credit card problems, financing issues, payday and title loans, and general consumer lending complaints. And number five, our collection agencies. And a lot of the complaints that we get in that area are complaints about the violation of the do not call list, calling at all hours of the night and day and calling to collect on debts that are either paid or years and years old. One of the things that we did in 2010 is we put all of our consumer complaints online. Now, those are public record, and they have always been available to the public, but in a paper form. We felt that making it more available to the public would be helpful, so that if you were interested in buying new tires, you could decide whether to go to the shop down the street or somewhere else, in part by determining whether the shop down the street actually has had a lot of complaints. So now you can just simply go to our website. It's the tag name is Be Informed. Just punch in the name of the business, and you can identify the number of complaints that have been filed against that company and see how they've been resolved. We actually worked closely with a number of industries to see if they had any concerns or recommendations, and they did. For example, there are a number of industries that have a large number of complaints, in part because they have millions of consumers. So we have an adequate disclosure that indicates that just because a company has had a complaint doesn't mean that they're a bad company. Oftentimes, they will just simply have too many consumers that are overloading their switchboard. So we have a number of disclaimers on our website that give information to the consumer to put the complaints into context. We also indicate how the complaint was resolved, so that if a consumer is able to resolve it directly with the business without any problem, it's so noted on the website. In 2010, we also teamed up with Treasurer Wheeler to initiate litigation against a couple of different banks. One of the things that we do is we are involved in representing the Oregon Public Employees Retirement Fund for securities violations. And if you have been under a rock or out in the wilderness for the last 3 years, you might not have known that there has been a financial meltdown. Well, OPERS, the retirement fund, along with a lot of other investors, have lost a lot of money on Wall Street. And we initiated litigation against Countrywide after OPERS lost about $29 million. And we also initiated litigation against the financial giant Bear Stearns. And both of those cases were a result of representations by the companies that misrepresented the value of their securities when they issued the securities and they were purchased by the OPERS funds. Now, one area that we're very active in is healthcare fraud. Each of us, at different points in our life, will get involved in the healthcare system. And Oregon consumers pay a lot of money for our healthcare, whether it's through our insurance or through medications or otherwise. And we have gone after a number of major healthcare companies who have illegally marketed their medications for unapproved uses, for failing to meet drug safety requirements, or engaging in illegal kickback schemes. In 2010 alone, our Medicaid fraud and our financial fraud units recovered over $33 million for Oregon consumers and the Oregon Health Plan. And that is a result of aggressive litigation that we've pursued against companies such as AstraZeneca Pharmaceuticals, Bayer, GlaxoSmithKline, and Omnicare. Protecting seniors is also one of our priorities, and for example, we initiated a case against a security alarm company that was targeting elderly people. They would go door to door, and the elderly are frequently at home and therefore more victim to these kind of scams than you and I who have jobs during the day. The company would go and offer them a free security system that, in fact, actually cost them $40 a month and locked them into a 60-month contract. The consumers complained to us, and as I described earlier, after we got one complaint, we handed it off to the company, and after we got a series of complaints, it percolated up through our system, and our lawyers got involved, and that's when we initiated an investigation. We received a settlement that reimbursed all of the consumers that complained to us, and we were able to nullify all of the contracts and rescind those contracts so that the consumers were not stuck paying $40 a month for something they thought was going to be free. As I mentioned, in the telecommunications area, we get a large number of complaints, and because telecommunications is oftentimes a multi-state issue, we get involved with offices of other attorneys general from across the country. And in this past year, we reached a multi-state agreement with DirecTV, one of the largest satellite television service providers in the country. It was a two-year investigation, which is common for some of our larger cases, and it involved misleading sales and advertising tactics, including promotional cashback and free trial offers. The multi-state agreement resulted in DirecTV making payments across the country of in excess of $13 million and revising its sales practices, paying restitution, and providing to the Department of Justice $600,000, which will allow us to continue our consumer protection efforts. As I mentioned, the financial meltdown has caused a lot of problems in our state, not the least of which is mortgage fraud. And the mortgage fraud activities that we're involved with range from the front end of consumers misrepresenting their financial worthiness and falsely obtaining a loan to the back end of foreclosure fraud. In 2009, when the Attorney General took office, the Department of Justice did not have a single lawyer who was dedicated to focusing on foreclosure-related fraud. Because our state budget was tight at that time, we were able to get federal funds to put together a mortgage fraud task force that has assisted homeowners both on the civil side and also pursue convictions on the criminal side. In one of our first cases, we sent a Salem mortgage broker to prison for 61 months for committing fraud, theft, and tax evasion, and he is ordered to pay a total of $469,000 in restitution to more than 100 victims. We have also received a sentence of 3 years for a Marion County man who was perpetuating mortgage fraud along with drug schemes, and he was using the proceeds from his drug sales to purchase homes and launder the money. And it was a fascinating case, but quite complicated. And last but not least, on the criminal side, we were able to find a guy literally as he was just getting onto an airplane to head to Texas to avoid arrest. We arrested him before he got on the plane. He was later convicted and sentenced to 3 years for bank fraud in a scheme that built homeowners in Oregon of over $300,000. Now, we're fortunate to have good working relationships with members of the legislature, and in August of this past year, the Attorney General met with Representative Richardson, and they met a Medford couple who had paid $1,500 to a loan modification company, yet their home went into foreclosure. The company actually did nothing. They took their money and led them down a path into foreclosure. We promptly investigated, indeed found that they had violated the law on a number of occasions. We recovered the money for the couple and assisted them in an effort to avoid foreclosure. That was one example of a company that we have been able to ban from the state of Oregon, and there are a number of others, including the U.S. Mac Law Group, Liberty Law Firm, NOAA Savings Mortgage, Premier Legal Advocates, National Homeowners Assistance, and American Mitigation Group. Those are companies that have violated Oregon law, and not only do we get restitution, but in our belief, if they're not complying with our law, they shouldn't be allowed to do business in our state. We're fortunate to have very good working relationships with DCBS, who regulates some of these companies, and sometimes we'll work in tandem with them. And we are fortunate to have their assistance and expertise in many of the cases that we handle. So those are some of the high points of what the Department of Justice has done over the last year and a brief description of our activities. I'll be more than happy to answer your questions.
Riveting. Questions from the committee? Representative Sheehan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The Attorney General's office deals a lot with fraud, but it doesn't seem like they do any sort of advocacy when it comes to a business defrauding another business, whether they close up shop and start up again under another name. I just hear it from a lot of businesses in my area. It's happened to me in my business where someone has closed down and just started up again, and I've contacted your office, and the answer was, well, it's a business. We can't deal with it. I see businesses as a consumer in Oregon. Can you speak to that, or why do you have a definition for what a consumer is, and why are you not doing that for businesses?
Co-Chair Hovey, Co-Chair Wisnant, Representative Sheehan. It's a good question, and one of our challenges is that we can only apply the law that we have that's within our jurisdiction, and the state's Unlawful Trade Practices Act does not apply to business-to-business transactions. So it's only when a matter percolates up to the level of a criminal dispute that we would frankly get involved. And our criminal justice lawyers have been involved in some fraud cases where a business has actually defrauded another business. But because our UTPA doesn't apply to business transactions, we just simply don't have a tool that we can use.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Matthews.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thanks for the presentation today and stellar work. My question is regarding the scam alert. How's that broadcasted, and is there a link that citizens can just kind of forward an email to get those alerts directly, or is that the way that would work?
Co-Chair Wisnant, Co-Chair Holvey, and Representative Matthews. The scam alert is sent out by email. To show you my technical deficiency, I'm not sure what it would mean to do it as a tweet or a Twitter, and I suspect we're looking at that. But the email can easily be forwarded on to neighbors, friends, relatives, just like any other email can. And we would certainly be open to coming up with other ideas on expanding the broadcast of the information. So I'd certainly be open to your suggestions.
And Mr. Chair, just a quick follow-up.
Are
we by chance on that scam alert for our emails, or can we be added? Is that something we should be looking at?
Co-Chair Wisnant, Co-Chair Holvey, Representative Matthews, happy to add you and anyone else that wants to be involved. It's easy to do yourself. You can log on to our website and enter your email address, and I'll be sure to put you on it.
I'll take care of it. Thank you.
And, Representative Wisnant.
Yeah, that's the final one. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Dubanovich, thank you for your testimony, and I echo what Representative Matthews said. Sounds like you're doing a great job for the consumer. We have two new members of this committee. We're also looking at general government. Could you remind me what your rate is you charge for other agencies now for your services? And also maybe briefly, I'll have some questions I'll submit to you in writing, but also mention the travel voucher, and that's hit the press of how that's working out as far as you representing one of our state employees. Thank you.
Co-Chair Holvey, Co-Chair Wisnant, hopefully I'll remember all of your questions. The rate, I'm not precisely sure what the rate is. I know it's less than $150 an hour. Having been in private practice for 25 years and only recently joined government service, $150 an hour is less than what a brand new associate at prominent firms in the Portland area charge. So that is a fixed rate regardless of how much seniority a lawyer has in the Department of Justice. So it's a really good deal. On the travel matter, I can't comment on the advice that we've given to state agencies, but suffice it to say that we do provide advice as procedures are proposed to us. And I know that the matter is pending before the Ethics Commission, and what they choose to do or not is dependent upon their deliberations.
Follow up real quick, Mr. Fuller. Thank you. In my first session here, it was $96 an hour for the rate. So, my question, I guess, is does Department of Justice, if the guy is guilty, you still have to represent him as far as, because he's a state employee. How does that work, or how do you make that determination? And I'm not judging the individual either.
Yeah, Co-Chair Hovey, Co-Chair Wisnant, we don't represent individuals before the Ethics Commission. We represent the Ethics Commission.
Okay. Thank you.
In this situation, they apparently chose to obtain separate counsel And that's between them and their employer, the treasurer, about how that reimbursement is taking place.
Thank you.
Representative Klim.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Does the office have a position on, this isn't Ways and Means, I know, but a position on this mechanism of revenue for the agency charging by the hour versus just getting an allotment and then you just provide services the way it's been done in past administrations?
Co-Chair Hulvey, Co-Chair Wisnant, Representative Klim, we don't have a position on that. I know that it is something that is we're well open to discussing with the legislature. We would love to find a more cost-effective, efficient way, and frankly, to some extent, it would be a lot easier for us to be funded as a lump sum budget and be able to allocate some of our resources around as needs change. I understand agencies want some predictability in their budgets, and hence they like the ability to have control over the payments to the Department of Justice. They can determine when they want to use us or not. One of the things that we've done is do some trial fixed fee arrangements with agencies so that they have some certainty, and it's worked out fairly well for both of us, I believe. We've been able to cover our expenses, and they've felt more comfortable calling us because they know that they're not going to be billed for every minute that they talk to one of our lawyers. But we're very much open to anything that we can do to facilitate cost-effective legal services in the state.
So, a really good presentation. I'm just going to add one item to your list, and that is, you know, I know on your website there is probably a link to the top 10 consumer complaints. It might be helpful for this committee. I'm sure our administrator can probably find it and get that to the committee members so they can take a look at some of your data and information on some of those consumer complaints. And just following along the same lines as Representative Wisnant, and I'm sort of curious, this committee's had some interim committee hearings on some general government type of issues which the Attorney or Department of Justice is sort of involved in, and that is around public contracting and model public contracting laws. And sort of curious, you know, how your agency, what do they do other than do the rulemaking on the model public contracting laws? And there's been a lot of complaints around the state about contracting agencies not following those laws, and a great deal of concern about it. And so I'm hoping that this committee will be looking at a couple of those issues. So just if you could give us a little background on your role, the Department of Justice or Attorney General's role in that field.
Co-Chair Wisnant, Co-Chair Hulvey, the Department of Justice prepares a manual for contracting that all state agencies have available to them. Just like in the private setting, we can't tell our clients what to do, and whether they take our advice or not is dependent on whether they sometimes like it or not. The agencies generally negotiate the contracts themselves and then, like in the private setting, come to us to document the contract. Oftentimes, they will have already prepared an outline of the agreement that we will then put into final form. We do not pass on whether it's a good agreement for the state or not. We don't have the substantive knowledge to make that decision. All we can say is that it meets legal sufficiency and accomplishes the objectives of the agency. Now, we also don't have the ability to review every contract to ensure that it complies with all contracting laws that we might not be aware of, because the agency in a specialized area may have some rules and regulations that we're not aware of. We would be happy to work with you, and if you've got some specific questions in that area, I'd be happy to go back and research the issues.
Okay. Thank you. Any other questions? Representative Smith.
Thanks, Mr. Co-Chair. What help do you need? What are the challenges that your office is facing? I mean, obviously, every agency is facing legitimate and necessary resource challenges. You know, you can mention those if you want, but sort of beyond that, what are, you know, tools you're lacking? What are ways that we're not as good as we ought to be?
Co-Chair Wisnik, Co-Chair Hovey, Co-Vice Chair Smith. Clearly, resources continue to be a challenge for us. As the economy worsened, the number of consumer complaints increased, and they continue to be essentially the same level as they were for the past couple of years. What's significant, though, is the dollar amount that's involved is probably larger than we've ever seen before, in part because we're seeing so many that involve home mortgages and things of that sort. And the biggest problem that we face there is that the federal funding for our Mortgage Fraud Task Force will expire later this year. And if that money goes away, then we'll be left with no investigators or lawyers involved in the mortgage fraud area. Now, I hate to say it, but foreclosure fraud is not going to go away in the state anytime soon because we have a foreclosure crisis. We're in the top four or five in the country on the number of foreclosures. Certainly the folks that live out in the Bend area, you know how horrible it is over there. It's a problem, and we continue to have a large number of cases arising in the foreclosure field. But the good news is I think that our relationship with the business community is top-notch. We've worked very well with the debt collectors, and they've frankly been quite compliant, the debt collectors in the state of Oregon. We continue to have problems with debt collectors from outside the state, in particular what are called third-party debt collectors, and these are people that buy 1,000 accounts from a particular Sears or Visa or some other credit card company. And some of these accounts are very, very old, and they'll just send out collection notices to every single person on the list, even if it's a 10-year-old debt. Indeed, we received a complaint recently from a consumer who got a call late at night from a debt collector about a debt that her father had a decade ago, and her father is deceased. So that's the kind of complaint that we're receiving, and those continue to, you know, be fairly time-consuming for us to investigate, figure out where is the company that's making the call, and do they have any legitimate basis for pursuing the claim. And unfortunately, as consumers are unable to pay their debts, the number of debt collectors continue to be a problem in the state.
Thanks. I just want to say, I think just about everybody, probably every member of this committee sort of appreciates the work and knows that you guys are taking a 3X, 4X, you know, pay cut to do this stuff. I've been impressed with the people that the office has attracted, so yourself included. So thanks.
Thank you very much, Mr. Dubanovich, and hope to see you back in the committee on a couple of the topics we'll probably be discussing in the future. I appreciate your time and the Attorney General's willingness to have you here in front of us today. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
So next up, we have from the Secretary of State's office to talk to us a little bit about their agency and its role in general government. We have Barry Pack, Deputy Secretary of State, and Gary Blackmer, Director of the Audits Division. Good morning, gentlemen, and if you would identify yourselves for the record, please.
And good morning, Co-Chair Holby, Co-Chair Wisnett, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Barry Pack, Deputy Secretary of State, and with me is Gary Blackmer, our Director of the Secretary of State's Audits Division. I have just a few brief comments to start off from sort of the 30,000-foot view policy direction that has been provided to Gary and his auditors from the Secretary of State, and then I'll turn it over to Gary as the certified smart person and expert on auditing to go through the work of his division in particular. Then at the end, I'm happy to answer any other questions about our role in general government as the committee has. Secretary Brown is a longtime advocate of outcome-based management and performance-based budgeting. It's work she worked on when she was in the legislature and was a perspective she brought to this agency when she was elected, and ran for that office in part to refocus the work of the Audits Division to ensure the taxpayer dollars were being spent as efficiently and effectively as possible. And so when she took office, there are sort of three primary issues that I want to address that she's been working on. And the first was to do an internal assessment of the organization. And as you'll hear from Gary, we have a number of audit types that we conduct. And in looking at the financial audits in particular, these are the audits that are done of agency accounting and books, particularly the statewide single audit, which is required every year to ensure that all the federal dollars the states received are being spent as they should be and is essential for the state to continue to receive federal money and issue bonds and all those sorts of things. They're really doing a fantastic job, and they're often underappreciated members of our staff who work tirelessly following the money to the penny and ensuring that it's being properly accounted for. It doesn't get some of the glamour of our performance audits, and so I just want to thank them if there are any listening, because they really do some tremendous work. But having said that, it became clear that some of the work in the performance audit arena needed to be refocused. And so we made a change in the leadership of the division. We're very fortunate that Gary Blackmer decided to leave the city of Portland, and we lured him to state service so that he could bring his nationally recognized expertise on performance audits to the state. And the simple direction really given to him, more audits and more savings. And I think part of how the Secretary describes her approach to this is that in the past, with all due respect to our predecessor, some of the audits were really looking at small things. They were looking at, as she describes them, the mosquitoes, the annoying insect that bites you and you have an itch and it scratches. But at the end of the day, that's really what it is. It's an annoyance. Whereas what an agency head is dealing with are the alligators biting at their ankles. And they're really looking for a way to club those alligators out of the way. And so that's what we wanted our performance audits to do, focus on the alligators, not on the mosquitoes. And I'll give you just one example. When the Secretary took office, there was an audit in process on state cell phone plans. It's a good audit. It identified some savings the state could find by better managing the plans, matching the minutes in the plan to the usage of the employee, making sure that an agency wasn't paying for a plan for a cell phone that was no longer being used. But the savings there were in the tens of thousands of dollars, not in the millions of dollars. So that's a good example of looking at mosquitoes, and Gary will give you a few more examples of looking at alligators. The second issue was to sort of reform our own internal processes and streamline the work that our audits do so that we can get more audits done without sacrificing audit standards. So reducing the number of auditors on a team, streamlining the approval and quality control process, so all of that is happening faster. And then asking Gary in the risk assessments they do to select audit topics to really keep in mind the general fund component of an agency. Given the economic times the state is facing, that really needs to be a strong focus of any efficiency work. And then the third issue she wanted to address was the implementation of our audit findings. And the key to compliance here, as you heard from Gary, is really being persuasive and having evidence so that by the time the audit is done, the agency is convinced our recommendations are the right way to go and they'll voluntarily move forward on them. But just to ensure and to sort of keep accountability on the table, we're doing a couple of things now. Our auditors are going back a year after the audit for a shorter follow-up audit to see how agencies are implementing our recommendations. And then the Secretary throughout that year and after meets individually with an agency head to have a one-on-one conversation about the barriers that might exist to implementing the recommendations or, you know, frankly, just if there's disagreement about a recommendation. We've begun some conversations this session with legislators about the need for a greater awareness among the legislature about our audits and our findings and the implementation of the recommendations. Some of the conversations we've been having with members, both Republican and Democrat, is the idea of including a report on a recent audit in an agency's budget hearing, So there's direct correlation between the performance measures, the performance and outcomes of the agency, our recommendations, and their implementation during the budgeting process. It seems a good mixture of appropriate oversight and accountability. And it seemed to us that was best done at a Ways and Means Subcommittee level, where the members are most familiar with the operations and the budget of that particular agency. Again, this is just an idea that's being discussed, and obviously it's up to the legislature to decide how you want to conduct your own hearings. But with that, I will turn it over to Gary for a little bit more detail and be happy to answer questions.
Thank you, Barry. Excuse me. Co-chairs Holvey and Wisnant, members of the committee, thank you for inviting me. My name is Gary Blackmer. I'm the director of the Audits Division in the Secretary of State's office. This is really a welcome opportunity for me to describe an organization filled with very dedicated professionals who perform many complex tasks. And I'll keep my comments brief so that there's time for questions at the end. Our mission is to protect the public interest and improve Oregon government. We conduct our work in accordance with government auditing standards, which were developed by the Government Accountability Office, the GAO, and they follow them, as do many other states and local governments. These standards require that we maintain our independence, that we hire and train our staff to be highly competent, that we exercise professional judgment and care, and that we take steps to assure the quality of our work. We perform five key types of activities within our office, and I'll give a brief overview of each, but then I'll concentrate on the new way that we're doing our performance audits. As Barry mentioned, our financial audits are a key responsibility. We audit to determine whether state agencies have properly prepared their financial records and their annual financial statement. Last year, we audited over 200 accounts in order to determine the reliability of those statements. These audits are often mandated by federal grants, or when the state is going out to borrow money, the credit rating industry relies upon our assurances that the statements are properly prepared. We also determine whether the agencies comply with federal requirements in order to continue to get grant funding. We also conduct information technology audits. This takes a special skill in terms of knowledge of software and hardware, and we determine whether the state's computer systems adequately protect public funds and electronic information and whether they operated as intended. Recommendations that we prepare are directed at improving electronic information security, practices, and procedures. We also monitor the municipal financial audits that are conducted of local government. We help ensure that those governments get the best possible professional audit services from their contracted CPA firms. We establish requirements for those municipal auditors and discuss issues with them based upon our reviews of their audit reports, and we go out, look at their work papers, and meet with them to discuss some of the issues that we identify. Our oversight role is mandated by statute, and it covers approximately 1,700 municipal organizations in Oregon. We also operate a government waste hotline. It's a way for public employees and members of the public to report fraud, waste, or abuse in state programs. The law provides confidentiality for those people who contact our office. And in 2009, we handled 347 calls. Since the hotline was authorized by the legislature in 1995, we've identified approximately $8.1 million in question costs. Performance audits is the area I'd like to focus on a bit more. We continue to look at risks that public agencies face, as well as the controls they put in place to ensure that those risks are controlled and our assets are protected. But we've also expanded the scope of what we look at to include the agency's mission and its objectives. We're asking our auditors now to understand what the agency's purpose is and what might be the obstacles out there that prevent it from achieving as much in terms of services to the public in quality, timeliness, or cost. And our audits don't stop there. We also look at the strategies for improving management practices and procedures to increase efficiencies, generate savings, and produce better results. We work to be a catalyst for change in these organizations, and we use tools such as performance measurement and performance management to guide them towards sustained improvements. Our audits engage the agency personnel, managers, as well as line staff in our questions and our analysis and of their results. By engaging them in these audits, we are likely to find the greatest potential areas for improvement. Asking these kinds of questions also builds accountability within the organization, and at the same time, it holds the agency accountable to the public. Our goal in each performance audit is to go beyond problems to also identify solutions and improvements that the agency can apply. In the same way that we want agencies to make the best use of their resources, the Secretary of State wants us to ensure that we are auditing the issues that most need improvement. We're constantly looking for potential audit areas, and we consider many factors before we start an audit. These include risks that are inherent within the program's services, the size of its budget, the availability of data, the potential benefits of an audit topic, the timing of the work, just to name a few. In the best of situations, we've chosen an audit topic where we find an emerging problem that we can alert the agency to solutions before it grows too big. We also want to identify problems across agencies and across governments that increase costs and reduce efficiencies. Let me describe three examples of some of the audits that we've produced with our new approach. All of our audits are posted on our website, and we try to ensure that everyone has an opportunity to know when we've just released an audit. We looked at the Department of Revenue at the request of the director, who wanted us to examine their filing enforcement and collections practices. We identified a number of strategies that they could use to better identify non-filers. For example, we matched up the filers that of IRS taxes and compared those names to those that filed with the state of Oregon, and we identified 66,000 individuals who had not filed and appeared to owe taxes. We estimated that they owed about $109 million in unpaid taxes, and we further estimated that based upon historical collections practices, the Department of Revenue could collect about $54 million of that amount. We also recommended improvements in their collections practices that we thought could increase their return rate. We looked at the Vocational Rehabilitation Program in the Department of Human Services, and this agency helps people with disabilities to find employment. But they had started to a waiting list because they didn't have enough resources to cover all the people requesting their services. We looked at what the agency was doing and its performance measures that it provides to the federal government, and found that the agency was doing a very good job of finding employment for those clients, but its costs were the second highest in the country among comparable states. So we started looking at how they were managing their costs and made a number of recommendations that reduced their costs. It appeared that it would enable them to increase the likelihood of their clients completing their training in a more timely way, and a greater likelihood of long-term success in terms of their occupational interests. As a result of our audit, the agency committed to a 20% reduction in its per-client costs. We looked at the Willamette Education Service District. This is a request from the Oregon Department of Education. And in this one, we had heard a number of allegations of financial problems, and we found extensive weaknesses in the agency in terms of missing documentation, commingled funds, overly complicated accounting transactions, inadequate controls over those financial transactions, poor contracting practices, and a management that did not respond to known problems. We weren't able to assess that agency's mission because the fundamentals of the organization were very weak, and we felt like the largest problem that we needed to deal with in that agency was its financial controls. Let me talk a little bit about our performance measures. We've examined them. We've made some revisions to them. Ultimately, they look kind of the same, but the way they're being collected is slightly different. we are strong advocates of performance measurement. We think that it's a good cue for an agency to understand what it's accomplishing, when it can make improvements. And we track three key performance measures in our division. Now, I guess I need to caution you that this year may be a little different than future years because it was a very good year for our performance measures. I don't know that we can necessarily achieve this level of accomplishment in the future, but we will certainly try. We identified $152 million in savings, revenue enhancements, or question costs in fiscal year 2009-2010. In the past, our audits typically identified $10 to $15 million in savings, and I hope that in the future we can achieve $20 to $30 million each year. But I want to also emphasize that we should not just focus on dollars, that our audits, by looking at mission, often find improvements in customer service, in client safety, and other critical non-quantity, non-quantifiable type impacts. And if the largest problem that we have is an agency that is not providing good care of its clients, then it, in those cases, I think it's more important for us to look for saving lives than saving dollars. And I have had audits in my career where we've identified findings that have saved lives. So I think that a typical mix of audits will have a goodly amount of savings, but also the less quantifiable impacts in terms of quality of services to Oregonians. Excuse me. In fiscal year 10, our performance auditors returned $64 for every dollar spent on their activities. Again, that's an unusually high return. In the past, we've averaged about $12 returned for every dollar, and my goal would be to double that in future years. Just as important as identifying savings is getting our recommendations implemented. We track the status of our audit recommendations, and in the past we've determined that 75% of those recommendations were implemented in the first year. What we're doing now is we have more ambitious goals that we set for ourselves and for the agencies, and it may take more than a year to implement those recommendations. Excuse me. And so what we've committed to is tracking all of our recommendations into the future, and we'll track them until they're implemented or until the agency says we're not going to implement it, and we'll be reporting publicly on that. So to the degree that we think that every recommendation we make is important, and we're not going to stop tracking it after the first year, which we did in the past, we're going to be tracking it and reporting to the public on how many of those are implemented. I'd like to close by pointing out that we're accomplishing all this work with the same number of auditors that we had 25 years ago, that we are really conducting all of our performance audit work with efficiencies that we found on our financial audit side. And to that, I owe a great deal of appreciation and credit to the dedicated professionals who have figured out how to do more with less over the years. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Questions? Representative Cameron. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thanks for your testimony today, both of you. I just a couple quick things that kind of came to mind. We heard testimony from the prior testimony about a website that you can go in and search about a business complaint. Do the complaints, and I know the confidentiality issue, but the complaints about agencies and where waste is, are those posted someplace where the public can go and see where those complaints are?
Chair Wisnett, Chair Holvey, Representative Cameron, we put together an annual report that provides a high-level analysis of those complaints. And whenever there are bona fide findings of waste, we do prepare a public report for it. But at this point, in order to protect the confidentiality, we have not wanted to provide individualized information on all the complaints that come in.
Okay. Can I follow up a couple questions?
Follow up. Sure.
So on the consumer protection side, we can file the complaint about the company. We don't worry about confidentiality there. But on the business government side, we are concerned about confidentiality. Can you help me with that?
Chair Wisnett, Chair Holvey, I guess we follow the statutes as they're written, and from the standpoint of what is being proposed in terms of some of the language around confidentiality that's being prepared by our office and by the Attorney General, I believe that that could change. But at this point in time, we do report at a higher level about, and an aggregate level about those complaints. Excuse me, and a large number of complaints don't deal with state agencies. We sort those out and send those on, and those that do, we do investigations and follow through on it and report specifically on those cases where we find fraud or waste or abuse. But in terms of the actual, releasing the information on individual complaints, we have not found that we can do that yet.
I think would be good is I'm not necessarily looking for the individual who filed the complaint, but and I don't know if on the Attorney General's website if there's any information about the consumer who filed the complaint, but what the actual complaint is about the organization, I think, may be something that would be interesting to have exposure to. If I may, Mr. Chair, a couple more.
Certainly.
Questions on the $152 million in audits. You said that was an anomaly savings. That's what you've identified, and I think you went on to further in your testimony talk about following up on how much will actually be tracked and saved. So we've identified $152 million. At what point in time will we be able to say, based on the actions as a result of the audits, the $152 million was actually saved?
Co-chairs Holvey, co-chairs Wisnant, Representative Cameron, we are going to embark on a follow-up audit in the Department of Revenue in probably April or May to see what they have done to enact our recommendations. And we're also going to add on another element to that audit to look at their tax auditing function. So we're combining the follow-up with another audit of Department of Revenue. On the Department of Justice side, we will be contacting them to determine what actions they've taken. That was on the child support enforcement audit, and that one we will be looking at their activities related to that function and reporting on that as well.
Okay, thank you. One more. You mentioned a less quantifiable service. Can you give us an example of what we do that we can't quantify?
Co-chairs Holvey, Wisnant, Representative Cameron, let me tell you, one of the audits I did when I was a Multnomah County auditor was we looked at adult foster care. And the county was following state guidelines in terms of its inspections of foster homes. My auditors went out surprise visits as opposed to scheduled visits, talked to the clients, not just to the caregivers, and as a result of that, we ended up reporting eight homes that six of them were subsequently closed because of poor living conditions for the people there. That's one of those that I felt like we were really not able to quantify the magnitude or the impact of that audit because the conditions we found in some of those homes were horrendous. Another audit when I was with the City of Portland, we looked at police staffing and the number of officers per hour and matched it up with the number of calls per hour and day of week. And what we found was a serious mismatch, and as a result of our recommendations, they changed the scheduling of their police officers and improved their response times. I can't guarantee that a better response time saved lives, but I think everyone would have put a huge value on that in terms of waiting for that officer to show up after a 911 call. So I think those are two prime examples. Let me talk about the Department of Revenue one also, because I think there's some qualitative aspects to that estimate of impact. We looked at tax year 2007 and came and identified $109 million that we believe was due in taxes. There were other tax years that we could have included in that. It would have been a substantially larger amount of work. So we couldn't expand and determine what the total amount was going back 3, 4, or 5 years. But we also recognize that there is a diminishing amount of money that could be collected the older the tax return was in terms of what should have been filed. So there's some estimates in there, and we chose to kind of choose a middle number in there. We could have gone higher if we'd done more work and tracked more years of non-filing, but we felt like it was appropriate to report it at the lower amount. The other way to think about it is, looking into the future, if we can get those 66,000 people to start filing every year, that would be $109 million a year going into the future. So there's a number of different ways we could have gone with that measure, and we tried to pick one that we thought was in the middle.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. And I know we're just running a little bit beyond our time, and audits are certainly a fascinating world, and appreciate your... I just have a couple of quick ones, and I didn't see anybody else jumping into this. Representative Conger, go ahead. I'll let you go first.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Mr. Blackmer, Mr. Pack, thank you for your testimony. I appreciate it. I have three quick questions, if I may. The first is, you said you audited 200 different accounts in detail. Do you have any sense of how many accounts there are and what percentage of accounts you're able to audit in a year?
We do sampling based upon what we saw in earlier years. I couldn't tell you what the total number of accounts are, but we look at the higher risk ones and the most significant ones, and we do sampling within those, but we also are building upon our experience from previous years. I'd have to get back to you on the total number of accounts in the state. I'm afraid it would be much larger than that.
I'm sure it would be significantly larger. It'd just be interesting to know if you're on a 100-year cycle to get through all accounts or what. May I ask a couple follow-ups?
Certainly.
It'll be quick. The second is actually, I'm repeating a question by Representative Cameron, but I didn't understand your answer. I think he asked, you estimate in many instances what savings will be realized if your recommendations are implemented. Do you actually track to see if those savings are close to your estimate?
Whenever possible. And it can be difficult also, because it's difficult for us to go back to look at those 66,000 people and see how many of them did pay and what were the reasons for not accomplishing it. But we do try to monitor what the agencies are doing and see if we can determine it. But that would be another audit entirely. It would be as complex as the first one, and you know, it wouldn't necessarily be as valuable as finding other savings.
And last question is just your website or your waste hotline, government waste hotline. How are you making people aware of that, both inside government employees and outside public service?
We have a website. People can contact us through the website. We have a 24/7 phone number they can contact us at. We have posters that we post in a lot of public. We send them out to all the agencies to post in public places. We put out an annual report with a press release. We try every way we can, and we're looking for ways to promote the information and opportunity as well.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Wisnett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Deputy Pack and Director Blackmer, thank you for your testimony. During the interim, Mr. Blackmer gave us some testimony that was very informative. Very impressed. You said you did contract out some services. I have several questions I'll put in writing. I'm especially interested in the Willamette ESD. Also, your facts or your statements about the disability employment. Also, that you have the same FETs you had 20 years ago.
25
years ago. So thank you for your testimony.
Thank you as well, and I want to thank you for coming to our interim committee. And I can't remember specifically, though, but we also had the Multnomah County Auditor here in December, and I don't know if you heard their testimony. And so my question kind of revolves around that a little bit, because you do have the task of looking at or making recommendations for municipal financial audit monitoring. And as you know, I've been perplexed about how your agency works and what exactly generates an audit of a local government, of a municipal, of a taxing district that's not a state agency. Because I've found that though they may have some audit requirements, there doesn't seem to be an accountability mechanism when complaints are filed about them following the law or their financial audits are not appropriate. There doesn't seem to be anywhere to go. And so, except to the Secretary of State. And so what generates the Secretary of State looking at a local government or reviewing their audits or auditing that local government or other agency that's not a state agency?
Co-Chair Hovey, Co-Chair Wisnant, we make sure that their financial statement is properly prepared, essentially, or at least that it's audited in a way that ensures that it is properly prepared. So that's where our responsibility ends as far as the statutes around municipal audits. I guess from my perspective, there are 1,700 municipalities out there, and I've been very busy auditing state government, so the idea of trying to also stretch across local governments would be very challenging. And I guess from my perspective, we depend upon the voters to make judgments about when their leadership is not acting properly as much as anything else. I don't know that.
And Co-Chair Holley, Co-Chair Wisnant, I think a practical consideration as well is simply cost. State agencies pay an assessment to fund the work of the Audits Division. Whether they get audited or not, everyone pays into the assessment with the assumption that come sometime they're going to benefit from our audit work. Local governments don't pay. And so if we were to go in and audit a local government, particularly, you know, we get requests about school districts and small local governments, they frankly just don't have the funding. And if they're already providing their own internal auditor or their own local auditor to audit the financial statements, you know, we make sure, as Gary mentioned, that those are properly prepared. But there are practical barriers to our involvement at that level.
Thank you. And part of my question was not necessarily around the actual financial documents that they prepare, which I believe I found out recently that those are all filed with the Department of Revenue, you know, for all the different taxing districts. But it was more in line of the part of the financial audit, and maybe it's not the financial audit that looks into whether or not they're following the state and federal requirements and laws. You know, as part of their mission of serving the public. And that was the piece that I've heard many complaints about, and certainly Multnomah County has a mechanism for that, but I believe they're the only county that really does have that.
Co-Chair, wasn't it? Co-Chair Holvey, yes, Washington County also has an elected independent auditor. City of Portland does. Gresham does. Bend, I should say Deschutes County does. Lane County. So they do have some functions around the state, but it's not something that's uniform. I actually visited Eugene on two different occasions to try and get a charter auditor function going there, and it was turned down by the leadership there.
Well, and because we are running a little bit late, I'm sure we'll have some more discussions around the Secretary of State's role. I was also wanted to touch on the Corporations Division a little bit in terms of general government, but maybe we'll do that at another time, because I'd like to move on with some other agencies. So I really appreciate your presence here, and thank the Secretary of State for making you available to this committee. I'm sure we can follow up with some other questions.
Yeah, Mr. Co-Chair, can I ask a question, not to be answered, but for follow-up information after? Certainly. It would be helpful, we've talked to folks inside our state, outside our state, and our performance measures sort of agency-wide get sort of middling marks, and in terms of are they more or less likely to be outcome measures versus not outcome measures, are they more or less likely to be closely linked to the work and actually pretty, track performance well, are they more or less likely to be sort of teaching to the test or sort of really with public interest in mind, and I want to be sensitive to our timeline. To the extent you guys can get us an answer at some point about the Secretary of State's role and helping us think about that, some of that's governor stuff, some of that's agency stuff, some of that's you guys stuff, that'd be helpful.
And following up on that, I really appreciate your presence at the Committee for Performance Excellence, where many of those issues are being discussed. So, and I know you're not, it's not really part of your designated role, but appreciate your input there. It's valuable. Thank you very much. Representative Clinton.
I have a question. It's just a request. Barry, could you come and visit with me about the piece of legislation dealing with the LLC form? I just want to get your take on it before I start asking for hearings.
Absolutely. Thanks.
Yes, and I believe you'll be visiting with our committee concerning some of your legislation as well. Thank you very much. Appreciate it. Next up, running a little bit behind schedule here, apologize for that. We have Brett West, Administrator Operations Division from the Department of Administrative Services.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Co-Chair Wisnant, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Brett West, Operations Division Administrator at the Department of Administrative Services. I can do that in one breath, but barely. I believe you have a large piece of paper that we handed out that talked about DAS and our strategic planning efforts. It would look like that. We did want to project that for you, but this document's a bit of a beast, and paper works better for this. The Department of Administrative Services exists to serve state government so that that benefits the people of Oregon. It's a new mission statement we developed, partly coming out of a budget note we had in our last budget bill that directed us to convene a work group and take a look at our organization structure, our service versus policy delivery aspects, and our funding mechanism for the agency. We did have legislative membership on that committee, Senator Winters, former Senator Schrader, Representative Richardson, Representative Nathanson, and Legislative Fiscal Office. And you can actually find the final report on our website, the House Bill 5002 budget note. And I can send that link to your committee administrator for your review. We wanted to focus on some high-level outcomes. We wanted to provide the right service at the right time at the right price for state agencies. We wanted to provide effective, high-quality governance and oversight and have that in reverse govern and oversee our work. We want to have knowledgeable, skilled, diverse, and engaged workforce and respect among state agencies and the people of Oregon. That last piece is actually one of our outcome measures. We believe that citizen perception of state government is up to all of us to improve, and so we wanted to be very clear that that was something we care very much about, and I'll talk a bit about that a little bit later. We have some strategies in place that guide how we do our work. We want to continuously improve everything we do, and we do that by examining our processes, by listening to our customers, and listening to our employees. We listen to both of them through surveys. We get detailed results that we can act upon, and so far that has gone very well for us. We want to improve our performance through accountability, continual learning, and entrepreneurial management. And I'll talk a bit about entrepreneurial management later. We also want to advocate effective policies, remove barriers to success for agencies, and we want to partner on policy and service delivery decisions. Traditionally, we've spoken about the work that DAS does in terms of our organizational structure and the work that each of our nine divisions does. But our work really is focused on breaking down any silos that we have remaining across those divisional boundaries. And so the core values that you see along the middle of the document really are the work that we do. And I'll give you specific examples for each one of those. Leading enterprise opportunities, we know that frequently DAS is asked to do some things that don't well fit in other agencies. It could be something around information security. It could be any number of things, consolidation of mainframe software, for example. And we believe that we're in the right position to help lead those efforts. We want to effectively manage statewide policies. Those policies tell agencies what they need to do in the area of, let's say, human resources, information security, or accounting guidelines. And those policies often are what the Secretary of State audits do, and you just heard some testimony about that. Managing the fiscal environment, our agency sets the budgeting guidelines for all state agencies for agency request and governor's balanced budgets. You weigh in finally for legislatively adopted budget. Same thing for accounting, we set those standards. Managing risk is a big part of what we do. We have the statewide internal auditor as part of DAS. A large amount of risk management around human resources. We do manage the risk fund for the state, so we have a very large presence in this area. Workforce development is important to us, both for our employees and for those of other state agencies. Providing and delivering goods and services, this is a large part of what our agency does. We print documents for state agencies. We print your agendas during the session, all of the bills that come out. The statewide procurement office is part of the Department of Administrative Services for contracting issues. And we have the state data center in this area as well. Managing assets, we want to make sure our buildings are well taken care of. And we want to effectively manage our information assets. The state and the Department of Administrative Services specifically owns a lot of sensitive information. We have the HR systems for the state, accounting systems, and we want to make sure our security is as good as it can be. We leverage technologies by working with other agencies to help them with their large projects. We help them plan, we help them set budgets, and provide quality assurance to some of those things. And then we have some supporting processes around planning, managing performance, and engaging our partners. Engaging partners is very important to us. The State Data Center, I think, is a good example of how we do that. While it often gets beat up a little bit, we actually have three governance committees that are set up to govern the rates and services that are provided by the State Data Center. We have a finance committee that's made up of agency heads and fiscal staff to help us set rates so that we're appropriately recovering our costs and charging agencies appropriately. We have a CIO council that helps determine the direction for the technology piece, and then a group of agency heads convenes on a monthly basis to talk about overall direction for the data center. That really is the model that we look to implement in the future if we can, with your help, implement entrepreneurial management. I would like to talk about the outcome measures that are along the very bottom of the sheet. You had a brief discussion about those a moment ago. We know that our current KPMs that we'll be reporting on to Ways and Means really don't help us do the work we need to do or report what's important to us. So we developed a set of outcome measures that we think do help with that. Citizen perception, I mentioned a moment ago. Customer satisfaction, all agencies have to report on that. But that's one that's very important to us. Employee engagement, we want to make sure our employees are fully engaged and making recommendations to make our processes work as well as they can. We want to set effective policies, again, so that everyone knows what the expectations are. And I think it's important at this point to say that when we set policy, what we want them to do is be very clear. We want to assign accountability very clearly because often accountability rests with the agencies for the policies we put in place. So for accounting guidelines, for example, the Secretary of State audits agencies, and they are the responsible party for doing that review for us on our policies. We want to make sure our cost per transactions are as low as they can be. Cost per transaction includes things like processing payroll checks or provisioning servers out at the state data center. Many more examples of that. On-time delivery is another one. We want to make sure our customers are getting what they need when they need it. Again, partner engagement. And then the organizational health of our organization. We want to make sure that our workers' comp experience is low. We want to make sure that we're doing all the things you need to do to have an effective state agency because we feel that we are, in many ways, the model for what many other state agencies should look like. We will be coming back here at some point in the future with House Bill 2160 to talk about entrepreneurial management. It's quite a bit different approach than state government generally takes, and we want to really focus on providing competitive services. And we've gone so far, we're in the process right now, we have not finished the work, as to identify some services that we have as marketplace, which we think could be provided either by other state agencies, by the private sector. In some cases, we have identified services such as the state data center as a utility, because we know that through economies of scale, we can drive prices down. And because the data center is not fully mature at this point, we want to make sure that gets a chance to mature before we look at any other type of model. We also think it gives more flexibility to agencies, and having them be taking part in governing bodies that oversee our work and our rate setting, very important to us. Because I know you're running a bit behind schedule, I will stop there and answer any questions you may have.
Questions for the committee? Representative Cameron.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thanks for your testimony, and I appreciate this organizational chart and some of the things that you've said. The bottom line says outcome measures, and I'm concerned on how we measure, how does your organization measure citizen perception, customer satisfaction, employee engagement, effective policy.
Co-Chair Holvey, Co-Chair Wisnant, Representative Cameron. For citizen perception, we will use, our plan is to use Davids, Tibbetts, and Midge Hall. They do a periodic survey of the public. They report on that regularly, and we've been involved to some extent with them in helping to design one specifically for us. So we didn't want to reinvent the wheel, but wanted to use something that was already in place and reported upon. And Adam Davis frequently reports on citizen perception to different groups. For customer satisfaction, we've developed customer satisfaction surveys that we send out to all state agencies. And we've tried two different approaches. One is to send out a pretty comprehensive survey to all state agencies who use our services. That's provides some really good information, but can be a bit cumbersome. So we're also in the process of developing transactional surveys so that if someone is obtaining a service from any one of our areas, at the time that service is over, the email has a little link that you can click on, and they can report back very quickly on the specific transaction. With employee engagement, we've also developed a survey to send out to all of our employees. We had about, I won't remember the percentage that responded last time, so I won't say that, but a good percentage of our employees sent back feedback that we found very actionable. There were a number of themes in there, and some of it not always easy to read, but we go through that, and we actually talk about it as an executive team and then develop strategies to address the concerns that come up.
Mr. Chair, that would be, I think that would be helpful if we had, under each one of those outcome measures, specifically what the plan is and how you're tracking those outcome measures and over a period of time.
Yeah, Co-Chair Holvey, Co-Chair Wisnant, Representative Cameron, we're actually doing, this binder here actually has much more detail than what you see here. Under each one of these outcome measures, there are a number of process measures that roll up into each one of these, and that's something that we do intend to share in the future.
Thank you.
We've only just begun, though.
So is that something that you do with the audits division or?
Co-Chair Holvey, no, not at this point, but we do have other state agencies involved in helping us set what our measures are and what our targets should be.
Thank you. Other questions? Representative Wisnant.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. West. Mr. West reminded me we worked together, I think, my first session with his Department of Education. I think I can speak for Representative Smith, and we want to always tell you how great an employee you have in Mrs. Taylor. On our House Bill 2500, she went beyond the call of duty, very dedicated, very professional, and I would say she sets the standard for all state employees.
Thank you.
I have several questions. I gave you a heads up. I'm going to read in the record to save time. But thank you for your presentation today. But due to our time crunch, I'm going to submit these in writing, and they may also be more applicable to relevant to Ways and Means process. And I would appreciate an answer by February the 15th so I can make them available to the other committee members. Does DAS FETs for the 2011-2000, or provide us your FTEs for the last three budgets? Do you have any FTEs which have been vacant for 6 months or longer, and do you have a policy for monitoring vacant FTEs? How many deputies and assistant positions does DAS have? Does your span of control for managers and supervisors comply with your policy, which I think is 14? How many layers of management does DAS have between the director and the line workers? Is DAS work steady, or do you have periods of extreme peaks and valleys, and so you can contract out these functions? And do you have a policy for evaluating that option? I look forward to working with you. I'd like to know. I have two bills that sort of we're holding back on 2160 for a couple of reasons, but I'd like to talk to whoever I should in your agency to work on 2160. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We'll have someone talk to you about
that. Certainly, and I look forward to seeing the answers to those questions, Representative Wisnant. I appreciate, I don't see any other questions for you. I appreciate your overview of DAS. I think oftentimes is a sort of an unknown agency out there. We hear a lot about, but oftentimes don't see. So I appreciate your overview of what your agency does, and look forward to conversations with you about other legislation coming before this committee. Thank you very much. And thank you for getting us back on schedule.
My favorite thing to do.
So, speaking of performance, next up we have the Department of Consumer and Business Services. We have Scott Hara, Teresa Miller, and David Tapman to give us a little overview of what your agency does in the realm of consumer protection and general government.
Good morning.
Good morning. Welcome. And introduce yourself first for the record, please.
I will do that. Mr. Co-Chairs, members of the committee, my name is Scott Hara. I am the Acting Director of the Department of Consumer and Business Services. With me today are the heads of two of our divisions, Teresa Miller, to my right, Administrator of our Insurance Division, and David Tapman, to my left, Administrator of our Division of Finance and Corporate Securities. We appreciate the opportunity today to be here to give you an overview of the department's role in protecting Oregon's consumers. The Department of Consumer and Business Services is the state's largest regulatory and consumer protection agency. Our mission is to protect and serve Oregon's consumers and workers while supporting a positive business climate in the state. We don't view the two parts of our mission as opposites or alternatives. In our view, a good regulatory system is one that protects consumers and workers while allows Oregon businesses to keep providing jobs and opportunities for our Oregonians. Our major programs in the agency are the Workers' Compensation Program, Oregon OSHA, Building Codes, Insurance, and Finance and Corporate Securities. We try to focus on areas where there are real concerns, and we work to improve outcomes rather than just processes. We use a variety of approaches to achieve our results: education, training, and consultation, in addition to regulation and enforcement. We structure our regulatory programs to impose the minimum burden on regulated businesses, consistent with the outcomes that we are trying to achieve. We believe in customer service, and we try to make good use of technology to make it easier to interact with us. And we look for ways to measure our programs and approaches and make sure that we're achieving the right results. Our goal is to ensure that our services provide value to consumers, workers, and businesses. And I believe in your packet we have a couple of examples where we use that information to monitor our progress and process in the areas that we regulate. I want to briefly mention a couple of our programs, Oregon OSHA and Workers' Compensation, which are, of course, related to each other. Oregon OSHA focuses on keeping workers safe, and Workers' Compensation focuses on ensuring that workers, who are injured receive appropriate benefits and assistance in returning to work. Through Oregon OSHA, we administer a state plan for occupational safety and health that must meet federal standards and is approved by the federal government. We promulgate health and safety rules and standards, and we have an active consultation and training programs through which we work with employers and workers on a voluntary basis to help them make their workplace safe. And, of course, we enforce workplace safety and health standards through our inspection and accident investigations. Our goal is to have every encounter with Oregon OSHA be a positive learning experience about safety. In our workers' compensation division, we administer and enforce Oregon's workers' compensation laws to ensure that employers provide workers' compensation coverage for their workers and that workers who are injured receive timely and accurate benefits. We provide dispute resolution and also oversee a number of programs aimed at assisting injured workers to return to work. Our Building Codes Division is responsible for the adoption and interpretation of a consistent set of statewide building codes. We also license electricians, plumbers, and construction inspectors. In the area of plumbing, electrical, mechanical, and structural permitting and inspection, we share responsibilities with local jurisdictions. A local jurisdiction may opt to provide its own permitting and inspection, and we provide those services in the parts of the state, mostly rural areas, where the local jurisdiction chose not to do so. We also provide statewide inspections, where we're the only provider of that service in several areas, specifically elevators, boilers, and manufactured housing. This committee will most likely see issues involving the department's financial programs. We regulate insurance, banks, credit unions, non-depository lenders, including consumer finance companies, payday and title lenders, mortgage lenders and pawnbrokers, securities, and a cluster of other financially related programs such as check cashers, money transmitters, and pre-need funeral trusts. We'll start with the insurance division. We monitor insurance companies' financial condition to ensure that they'll be able to pay claims. We enforce insurance laws aimed at the fair treatment of the insurance buying public. We review some types of insurance rates and policy language. And we provide consumer education and work with consumers to resolve insurance-related complaints. Insurance is almost entirely state-regulated in this country. Unlike many other financial products, there is no separate federal regulatory oversight of insurance in most areas. State insurance regulators collaborate through the National Association of Insurance Commissioners, also referred to as the NAIC. So there's my first acronym penalty of the day. So there's a great deal of standardization and reciprocity. For example, if a state regulator meets accreditation standards set by the NAIC, as Oregon does, financial examinations of an insurer performed by that state will be recognized and accepted by other states so as to avoid duplication of effort and unnecessary costs. Another example of state cooperation is the Interstate Insurance Product Regulation Compact, often referred just simply as the Compact. The Compact was created to allow insurance companies to get new products approved and on the market in a timely and cost-effective manner. 38 states belong to the Compact, which reviews and approves insurance products that meet uniform standards, including consumer protections. Once approved, the products can be sold in each of the participating states. The Compact covers products in four insurance lines: life insurance, annuities, disability insurance, and long-term care insurance. House Bill 2095, which has been assigned to this committee, would add Oregon to that Compact. Access to high-quality, affordable health care continues to be a high priority with all of us. And with the passage of health care legislation by Congress, DCBS will play a major role in implementing the federal legislation. We'll be working closely with the Oregon Health Authority on these issues. The Insurance Division reviews health insurance rates for individual, portability, and small group health insurance. We are continuing to improve our health insurance rate review process, particularly as federal governments make additional resources available. The federal health reform law included a $250 million multi-year grant program to assist states in developing or improving health insurance rate review processes. The department received a $1 million for federal fiscal year 2010 to further enhance our health insurance rate review process. There are no state funds being used to support this project. While we already have one of the strongest and most transparent processes in the country for reviewing individual and small group rate requests, This grant funding is allowing us to increase consumer input on rate requests by funding a consumer advocacy organization to provide regular comments on rate filings, increase the scrutiny of rate filings and insurance company data by hiring an additional actuary and market analyst, require insurers to provide detail on medical claims costs, and fund a study on ways we might use the rate review process to lower premiums by addressing the underlying costs of health care. At this point, given our current statutory authority and all significant changes that have occurred in the past few years, we don't see any current need for further statutory changes. We are currently looking for ways to further improve our process, however, and there are a number of ways that we can do that within our existing authority. Oregon has one of the strongest rate review statutes in the country. We have been contacted by a number of states who are looking at our statute as a model for changes that they hope to make in their own state laws. In addition to our regulation of insurance, we also have the Senior Health Insurance Benefits Assistance Program, also known as SHEBA, which works with a volunteer network to provide counseling to seniors about their health insurance options. Our insurance oversight includes consumer advocacy. We help thousands of Oregonians with insurance-related problems and questions every year, and this consumer advocacy work also helps us identify long-term problems, which then can lead to rulemaking or legislative proposals. A key aspect of consumer protection is helping consumers understand how to evaluate their financial options, and this is the focus for us in both the insurance and our other financial programs. Because seniors often rely on their financial assets for income, they are particularly vulnerable to pitches for financial products that may be expensive or unsuitable for them, or in some cases might be outright fraud. One of our focuses over the past few years has been consumer protection for seniors, and we've done a lot of outreach to senior groups. As I mentioned earlier, the department also oversees state chartered financial institutions such as banks and credit unions. We enforce the state securities laws. We regulate mortgage lenders and consumer finance lenders, including payday lenders, car title lenders, and pawnbrokers. And we license pre-need funeral trusts, money transmitters, check cashers, and collection agencies. That responsibility lies within our Division of Finance and Corporate Securities. Our goal is to encourage a variety of financial options for Oregonians, but also to ensure that financial services and products are safe, sound, equitable, and fraud-free. Similar to our insurance functions, we monitor the financial solvency of those that we regulate. We ensure compliance with the consumer protection standards, and we are actively involved in educating the public on how to be wise users of financial services. In many of these areas, unlike insurance, the state shares regulatory responsibility with the federal government. For example, securities are regulated both at the state and federal level. Banks and credit unions can choose to either be a state or federal charter, and both state and federal institutions are subject to oversight by the FDIC or NCUA. We work closely with our federal counterparts on a variety of issues. The Dodd-Frank Wall Street Reform and Consumer Protection Act passed by Congress overhauled regulation of financial institutions with the goal of better protecting consumers. This included the creation of the Consumer Financial Protection Agency. It will be some time before we see the full implications of this broad sweeping piece of legislation, as federal agencies are still in the process of adopting administrative rules. This new law preserved the ability of states to adopt stricter consumer protection laws in many areas. The department has put forward Senate Bill 92, which helps to line up Oregon law with the new federal legislation. The economic downturn created new areas of concern. One area was the proliferation of entities offering to help those in debt. Some of these entities are legitimate and provide important services, but others are not. Their practices can be deceptive and even harmful to consumers who are struggling to manage their financial challenges. In response to these problems, in the 2009 legislative session, the department proposed and the legislature passed House Bill 2191. HB 2191 protects consumers who use debt settlement, debt counseling, and debt management services by limiting upfront fees, giving debtors the right to cancel contracts, requiring additional companies to be registered with the department, and specifying improper advertising practices. Members of the legislature sometimes ask whether bills that are passed actually benefit consumers. In the case of HB 2191, there has been a significant benefit. Since January 1, 2010, the date the bill became effective, the Division of Finance and Corporate Securities has been able to recover funds for 31 consumers, totaling over $57,000. This is in addition to halting the activities of companies that were not following the law and exploiting consumers. We want to thank Co-Chair Holvey for his leadership in helping us getting that bill passed in 2009. The Division of Finance and Corporate Securities took responsibility for oversight of appraisal management companies as a result of legislation passed in the February 2010 session. As you know, an appraisal management company receives residential real estate appraisal orders from mortgage lenders and uses a network of third-party independent contractor appraisers to perform the appraisals. The Oregon Legislature adopted House Bill 3624 requiring AMCs to register with the Department of Consumer and Businesses, verifying their competency of appraisers, establish a dispute resolution process, post a security bond, and submit to the department the fingerprints of certain individuals. I should add that DCBS was not originally the agency designed to oversee this program. At the last minute, the legislation was changed to move that function to our agency. As a result, the department convened several public roundtables to seek input from appraisers, financial institutions, mortgage brokers, the real estate industry, and AMCs on how to structure this new program. We also convened advisory committees prior to adopting our administrative rules. The program has been up and running as of January 1st, as was required by the bill. After reviewing the law and consulting extensively with stakeholders and looking at registration programs in other states, DCBS has identified changes that would help clarify the registration requirements and its enforcement authority. We have submitted House Bill 2086 for that purpose. However, there is a further complication. The Dodd-Frank bill requires that the regulation of AMCs be done by the same agency that regulates appraisers. For Oregon, that is the Appraiser Certification and Licensure Board. While the requirements of the Dodd-Frank provision do not become effective for 2 years, the legislature will need to address that issue at some point. A separate bill has been introduced to transfer the program to the Appraiser Certification and Licensure Board. And finally, I'd like to mention our enforcement activities. It is unfortunately the case that where money is involved, misconduct and fraud often follow. Overall, we opened 212 investigations in our financial programs in 2010. That does not include the work that our insurance division does. And we took 60 enforcement actions. These included cease and desist orders, penalties, license suspensions or revocations, and over 30 criminal cases that are in investigation or have resulted in indictments. We often work with other law enforcement agencies, including the FBI, the SEC, the U.S. Attorney's Office, our own Department of Justice, and county district attorneys. We look forward to discussing these issues further over the coming months. Thank you for your time, and we'd be pleased to answer any questions that you may have. Thank you for your patience also.
Thank you. That was a pretty long and thorough presentation of DCBS. I know it's a big agency and covers a lot of different activities, regulating business and protecting consumers and workers as well. So it was a good overview, I thought, and we have a document for every word you spoke, so I appreciate that. Questions from the committee? Representative Clem.
How much... Well, you can answer it later if you want to, but how much money is spent on the consumer advocacy portion of insurance oversight? And how is it funded?
Well, Messrs. Co-Chairs and Representative Clem, the funding of the insurance program comes through two pieces. I'll answer the easy part. The other part we'll probably have to get back to you on the exact amount that we spend on consumer advocacy. The funding comes from, is divided between the insurance companies and the producers or the insurance agents. So the agents pay for their portion of the regulation and oversight, and the insurance companies pay for their portion of the insurance and oversight. Most of that is through an assessment based on the earned premium that they write in the state of Oregon. So that's the short answer. Insurance agents pay their license fees to cover that portion. We also have the additional $1 million in federal dollars on rate review that from the federal government that is a new program for us, and that's an additional funding piece for the insurance division. We'll get back to you on the breakout of insurance consumer advocacy.
Follow up. Okay. Do you think there's any issues with the funding mechanism and the impartiality of the advocacy when the involved, if you're advocating against an insurance company, they're the one paying the bill for the person to do the advocating, are there problems there?
co-chairs, Representative Clem, that has not been a problem in the past. I think insurance companies understand the role that the consumer advocates play and that they're a necessary part in order to have a solid business model for them to run.
One more follow-up?
Certainly.
It's not a question, actually. Maybe we could just stick around afterwards and I'll visit with you offline. Not interested in doing it on camera.
And, of course, Teresa, if you have anything. Okay.
Other questions from the committee? I'm not seeing any. I appreciate your references to consumers by your department. It is one of your missions, and although it oftentimes appears that you just serve businesses, your mission really is to provide that level playing field out there and to protect consumers in their dealings with the economic and business worlds. I really appreciate your efforts. And I think Representative Wisnett has a letter that he'd like to present to you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you, Director Hare. I don't think we've met before. I enjoyed working on this committee during the interim and requested to stay on this committee. So, thank you for your testimony. Same questions basically I had for Department of Administrative Services. I'll give you this letter and ask you to respond by February the 15th so I can provide the answers to the other committee members. I'm also on full Ways and Means, so some of this information does affect policy, but I'll be looking for the information for the Ways and Means. Could you please provide your FTEs for the last three budget cycles that you've submitted? And could you also address FTEs which have been vacant for 6 months or longer, and do you have a policy of monitoring vacant FTEs? How many deputy and assistant positions does DCBS have? Does the management span of control comply with the DAS recommendation, which I believe is 14? How many layers of management does DCBS have between the director and line workers? Is your work steady, or do you have periods of extreme peaks and valleys? And then could you look at contracting out functions, and does management regularly evaluate this option? And finally, could you please explain the workman's compensation premium assessment administrative charge increase from 4.6% to 6.4%, which I think is a 39% increase. I've talked to your agency about this, and I'd like further clarification, and mainly ask you also to address, does this go for a new service or a new mandate that we gave you, or what does the funds go for? Thank you very much for your testimony, and I'll provide this letter to you. Thank you.
Thank you. And along those same lines, we get a lot of, or at least I do, I get constituent questions all the time about health care and premium costs. And it always comes out in the newspaper. Regents just had another 18% premium increase, followed by last year in the 20s and 18% for that, 12%, and just really some huge premium increases in health insurance. And they're always approved by the insurance division. So, you know, at some point, or maybe not always, but that's what constituents think. And so if you could provide us a little summary of how the division really looks at those premium increases and you know, what are the requirements? Because people are always digging up this information about their profits this year, how they're, you know, actually serving fewer people, and, you know, all these things that I hear and don't really have the data to answer their questions oftentimes. But it is a big issue that I hear about a lot. As healthcare costs are always pointed at being one of the huge issues that our economy faces, what business face and individuals as well, and just you know what kind of I guess review do we do of those premium rates would be appreciated.
Mr. Chair, for the record, my name is Teresa Miller. I'm the administrator of the insurance division at DCBS. And we did provide the committee a copy of the Health Insurance in Oregon report. I know it's a little bit daunting because it's about 70 pages. But we do actually have a section in here. In fact, I bet I can find it for you really quickly, that walks through our rate review process. In fact, it's on page 16, and it's titled Rate Regulation. It kind of does walk through exactly what we look at, what are the factors that we consider when we look at these. It talks about some of the changes we've made to make our process more transparent. For every rate decision now, we complete what we call a rate decision summary, because I think you're right. We get the same questions you get. Why are rates continuing to go up? And I don't think we approve them every time. In fact, oftentimes we reduce them, but I think your point is well taken in that if we're reducing a rate increase from a 15% down to a 13% or 12 or even 10, if I'm a consumer, I may not be all that excited about that decrease because it's still a 10 or 11 or 12% increase. And so part of what we're trying to do is be a little more transparent and as transparent as possible about here's what's going on, here's what's driving those rates. So in addition to this document, I'm happy to get you other information. In fact, I'm providing testimony tomorrow to a Senate committee that really does walk through our rate review process. I'm happy to get that to you as well.
Thank you, and I thank you for, because I haven't had time to look at your 70-page document yet, but I'm glad that it's in there. So it's good information. Did you have a question, Representative Smith? I'm certain we'll get to more discussions later. I look forward to working on any legislation this committee may deal with your agency. I've really been satisfied with a lot of the work that we've done in the past, and there's always more work to do. So with that, I appreciate your testimony today, and we'll sure have further conversations. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And I know Representative Wisnett has had a series of letters that he's introduced, and we'd like to share those with the committee if we could, and also the answers that we get back from his letter. All good questions that I look forward to the answers to.
Can we ask him how many deputies he's got? Oh, yeah, let's go talk to your wife about that.
Yeah, just
she's
one
extra.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So, any other discussion about the committee? We will be hearing bills coming up on Thursday, and Representative Wisnant will be chairing the committee on Thursday. And we look forward to getting started on a lot of the bills that have been referred to this committee, and look forward to your input on any of those bills. Certainly, you can give that input directly to either of us co-chairs, and we've agreed to share almost everything we can share with each other, so we try to move through this committee agenda together, and hopefully we'll be able to produce some good policy. That's my hope. So with that, I will adjourn the House Committee on General Government and Consumer Protection.
Good.